I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have I been looking forward to this hour? I hope we can get beyond elephants during the discussion, but if we don't, that's okay with me, because the elephant part of this book is just so interesting. Carl Safina is our guest this hour, and Carl is the author of Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. His work has been recognized with MacArthur, Pew, and Guggenheim fellowships. He has won many literary awards. His PhD is in ecology from Rutgers University. He's the inaugural holder of the Chair for Nature and Humanity. That's a nice position to have, nature and humanity, at Stony Brook University, where he co-chairs the steering committee of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. He is the founding president of the Safina Center. He hosted the 10-part PBS series Saving the Ocean, and Beyond Words is his 7th book. He focuses particularly on elephants in Kenya, wolves in Yellowstone Park, and killer whales in the Pacific Northwest, but he knows about so many animals, starting with homing pigeons when he was just a kid living in Brooklyn. So we're going to have fun and learn a whole lot this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Just call. Just call today. Carl, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks.
I'm thrilled to be with you. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it is going to be fun. So you, early on in the book, and I guess I want to know how new this whole area is, but it still is threatening, you write, for us to think, for many maybe animal people who are studying this, who didn't want to believe for a long time that other animals think and feel. And you ask, why do human egos seem so threatened by that thought?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, because I think a lot of people are threatened by that thought, and I think that it makes sense to not assume that they think or feel. It makes sense to assume that other people don't think or feel, for that matter, but then when you see evidence that they do, you're supposed to believe the evidence.
Right. Well, some of them don't, maybe.
Yeah.
Well. Not sure about that. So you go all the way to Kenya, and you show that you're vulnerable here, too. And you talk to this woman who's been studying elephants for 40 years in Kenya. And you're going thinking, you're going to find out, well, you know, how are elephants' minds like human minds? And she says something that makes you change the whole focus of your book.
Yeah, well, I asked her, how does watching elephants for 40 years help us understand humanity? And she said, I'm interested in elephants. I'm not interested in how elephants help us understand humanity. I'm trying to understand elephants. I've spent 40 years trying to understand elephants. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess that's really the right way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Who are we here with? And it's not always all about us. We're such incredible narcissists that we think that if we're going to study elephants for 40 years, it's because we want to learn more about ourselves. That's a little shallow, I realized. So I knew I had to go a lot deeper.
It is amazing, isn't it, that this woman has been there, and you describe her as alive and bubbling personality, and she's in her 70s. She's been looking at
Moss. She's very well known, and yeah, we can call her by name, because a lot of people have seen her on TV, especially in the 90s. She had a series of films on PBS about Echo the elephant, that she made very famous. Yeah,
mm-hmm. And she studied them for so long, for so many years. Did you, as you were looking through her eyes and other people who were there, you must have learned some remarkable things, because your book is filled with all of these behaviors that these animals have that obviously show empathy and show intelligence and show this familial bond, even show this sense of just pure joy and silliness.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, for me, it was endlessly fascinating. And probably, I probably was more interested more consistently in everything about writing this book than in any of the other books that I've done. Mm. Because, for other things, there's a lot that you may have to try to understand in order to explain the issue or something like that, and it's all it's all interesting, but this book, I felt like I had to constantly remind myself that I was actually writing a book, and I couldn't just continually immerse in the endless amount of completely fascinating information and just luxuriate in it. It was kind of like an intellectual spa treatment, reading all of this stuff all the time. And I had to frequently say, okay, you can't read the next paper until you write about the last 10 papers you've read.
There is this danger, too, and extinction of many of these animals. And so you're looking at how intelligent they are and what they do for each other and how they can recognize you. On the other hand, they're facing people who are killing them.
You know, actually, all of my work has had to do with the human effect on other species, especially ocean animals, and conservation issues. And I wanted to take a break from writing about and being immersed in conservation issues. And I wanted to get back to my initial interest, which was, in a perfect world, just simply what do other animals do and why do they do it and who are we here with? And I went to see these creatures in the most protected populations that they have. And in every case, their individual lives, their options, their behaviors, and their families were being affected by the mortal pressure. In other words, people were killing them.
I know.
The mortal pressure that they were facing.
Mm-hmm.
In every case. And I was trying to work around that, and then I realized that I could not write an honest account at this point in history without including the things that are affecting those individuals and those families directly.
Because if we're going to learn more about them, we certainly have to have them on Earth with us.
Yes, you know, and I will say, sort of getting back to our first point, if elephants and these other animals are going to teach us anything about ourselves, what they're teaching us is that we are becoming inconsistent with the continuity of life on Earth. That humans are reducing the population numbers of pretty much everything else that lives here with us. I think that's a terrible thing to have to learn by watching other animals, but it's, as I say, unavoidable. I tried hard to get around it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the cover of the book. We're going to put it, I asked Scotty to put it on our Facebook page because it's such a moving picture and it says a lot about the care that, you know, you ask the question, do elephants love? Can other animals love? You have to look at this picture and say, well, it looks like it.
Well, that photo on the cover is a very, very rare photo that almost no one has ever seen. And what it is that that is an absolutely newborn elephant that has never stood up before. And he's being helped to his feet by his mother and two of her sisters. In other words, his mother and two aunts are helping him to his feet for the very first time. That's what the cover is.
And they do so many things. They are so caring. And they obviously, this is kind of strange to me because I don't think of elephants this way, and I didn't know it until I read this part of your book, that they really do grieve. Tell the story of the elephant who died and how they responded to the death.
Right, right. Well, that's another thing that, you know, is almost never observed, is the natural death of an elephant and what her family and her friends do in response. And one of the things about elephants is that they live in female-led family groups. That's the center of their social structure. But some of those groups are particularly friendly with one another. And in the case of this one elephant that that died, that scientists there were able to observe, one of her friends continually tried to help her to her feet when she was still alive, before she had actually died, she had collapsed, and then stayed with her for several days, and then her family would come and stay for the night, and then they would leave and go to forage, and then they would come back, and then her friend returned again, and they visited her for days, and actually came back repeatedly over several weeks.
And then came back after she had died to sniff her bones.
Yes, that's a thing about elephants that is very unusual, probably unique among animals, and very noticeable, is that they are constantly visiting the bones of elephants that have died. And sometimes the elephants that linger the most, visiting, touching, fondling the bones with their trunks, are the ones that knew her the best, the members of her family or her children. And they often spend a lot of time touching the teeth in the skull. The teeth and the tusks would have been the most recognizable parts of those remains, because when they greet each other, you know, we usually give a kiss on the cheek, and they fondle with their trunks. They usually put their trunks in each other's mouth briefly as a greeting, or they touch the other elephant's tusks. So those would be the most recognizable parts.
Hmm. And the grieving is not just for elephants. Carl also writes about other animals, wailing, a beached whale, and hearing mournful sounds coming from the ocean from her partner, and a female wolf losing her mate. She had just had pups, and she was grieving, so she left the pups for a while to really just wander, and then returned after a grieving time. It's all just remarkable. And we're only, because our minds are only letting us begin to think of these animals as animals that may have empathy and love, and that we're not, you know, we're all here together, and so why do we think that we're better than anything else? And also what's happened with brain technology, which has allowed us to see into the deep recesses of the brain, too, so we can find out more about animals. Oh, it's all fascinating. Carl Safina is our guest. His book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And we are going to welcome some phone calls for him, too. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and joining me in our studios in Milwaukee, Lisa Nalbandian. We're in our year-end membership drive, and it is your chance to support the WPR programs that you count on every day, the programs that keep you in touch, informed, and interested. Your gift at WPR.org. or 888-202-2552 is very important as we end this year and look forward to 2016.
Phone calls, emails, that deadline. And I have that meeting in half an hour. I'll listen to WPR for a few minutes. That'll be a nice break.
17 of those are new members. We love it.
We're looking for your pledge of support.
Pledge drive? You've got to be kidding me. They have lots of business donors. I don't know why they call on the air to bother us for our measly dollars. What's the point?
The point, Aaron, is what you call measly donations add up to the single biggest piece of our budget.
No way.
No way what? That the radio's talking to you, or that your donation is a crucial part of our funding?
Both, I guess. But since you've got my attention, tell me more about the support from businesses. I hear them all the time. Doesn't that cover your costs?
We do have hundreds of business sponsors, and we're grateful to them. But back to listener support. Like I said, the single biggest piece of our budget comes from donors like you.
So you're saying I should give?
Do you value WPR programs?
Absolutely. I mean, I listen every day.
Well then, Aaron, it's time to give.
We really are talking to you. Don't make us come through the radio. Pledge now. Here's someone to tell you how.
I will do just that. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian, and we are asking for your gift to listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio during this year-end membership drive. Whether your pledge is $5 a month, $100 a month, we appreciate and we count on your gift.
There are a lot of reasons WPR listeners become WPR members. Maybe they think about or know that giving to Wisconsin Public Radio really makes a difference in your local community.
So your pledge today not only pays for the programs that you listen to, it also gives others a chance to discover WPR. Make that difference with $5 a month or whatever amount seems appropriate for you at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You turn on your radio to Wisconsin Public Radio and you're pretty much guaranteed to learn something. Maybe it's about the news of the day. Maybe it's a personal anecdote, some history, or even pop culture. But there's always something interesting going on.
Or elephants. You know,
or elephants.
What about
That's
elephants
right.
today, for heaven's sake. Listening to WPR reminds you that life is pretty fascinating, mm-hmm. and you're glad to always learn something new. The engagement you feel when you listen, it's worth your support. Give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And just know that giving takes just a few minutes. We need your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay. You can pay in one lump sum, or better yet, you can become a monthly sustainer. No matter how you choose to give or how much you give, use the next few minutes to support Wisconsin Public Radio, the station you count on. Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And a gift to WPR is a gift through Wisconsin Public Radio to the community. You enjoy this radio station, and so do many, many others.
Make your pledge right now for yourself, for your community at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Lisa, we need 11 pledges
okay.
now, and we have 35 or 36 minutes mm-hmm. to get them. So your gift right now will help WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And this pledge drive, you have a chance to do two good things at one time. Ask for food for 20. When you give $5 a month, or food for $40 when you give $10 a month. Do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're not already a sustainer, you can become one right now. It's very easy to set up a convenient, ongoing monthly donation from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
We have a donor from Madison who had something really interesting to say, and I'm going to share that now. He wrote, I grew up listening to WPR. I'm only 22 years old, and listening to WPR in the morning is one of my favorite parts of
Aww.
My routine. I know that when I donate, I'm helping to keep the programs me and my family love. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much is right. You're going to be really smart by the time you're 42. Say nothing of 62, huh? Thanks very much, Lisa, and thanks for all of your support. Carl Safina is our guest. His book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. We were talking about elephants and grief. Let's move beyond elephants for a moment. You also, in the book, talk about a female wolf who lost her mate and had just had pups. And she went off to grieve, didn't she?
Yeah, those pups were a few months old. They were old enough to feed on their own, so she didn't leave them, starving. But she seemed to need time for herself, and she left in the middle of winter. She went for a very long walk for more than a week in a very high, snowy place in Yellowstone where there was no food for her, no other animals. And when we talk about grief or any of these other things, it's easy to get confused over what we're talking about because different people have different ideas of what we mean by some of these words. So when we talk about grief, what we mean is that an animal that has known another takes time away from the normal things that they would be doing. To look for that other one or to break the normal routine of just general survival and to do things that are out of the normal for a while and then would come back into the usual rhythm of living. So she did that. She went on a long solo walk for many days in a brutally cold place, and eventually she did return to those pups.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned, I think in a TED Talk, Carl, of a beached whale, was it? And somebody who was observing the beach heard these mournful sounds coming from the ocean.
Yeah, that was a baby humpback whale that was ailing and washed ashore. I saw the whale that washed ashore, and it eventually died. It was alive when I got there. But then that night, the lighthouse keeper, 15 miles away, said that she heard, her words were incredibly mournful whale sounds coming from the ocean. That's how she put it to me. And she also added, no one will believe me, but that's what I heard.
Yeah, I believe her. I think you believe her. The circuits of the brain, you talk about our understanding of all of this is changing, maybe because we're thinking we're not top dog anymore and there are other animals worth knowing about, but also that some of the technology has advanced here. So are we able, through scans of the brain, to learn more about what is in animals' brains?
Well, sure. I mean, one thing is that the neurons are essentially identical between us and virtually every other animal. And most of the structures of the brain are identical and perform the same kinds of functions. The hormones that give us our moods and our motivations are the same chemicals that are in other animals' brains. And when certain other animals have psychological disorders like anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder, the same drugs that work for people work for them. We also have some people who do research, like they actually look at brain waves of certain kinds of animals while they're sleeping, and the patterns and the waves and the rhythms of those waves are identical to what happens when humans sleep and dream. So if people who have dogs, for instance, and see their dogs looking like they're dreaming, mm-hmm. that's because, guess what? They're dreaming.
You talk about animals, too, and we all know this if we've had dogs or cats or any kinds of pets that we've had. And certainly this was true of the elephants that you saw and of the wolves and so many animals. I'm wondering about the manifestation of personality. Do you see that in wolves? Do you see that in elephants? And what does that mean?
Well, my definition of personality is a different response to the same situation. And everywhere that people have looked for personality, they have found it. In all kinds of animals, not just complicated ones like mammals and birds, but even reptiles, even fish, octopus, things like that. And some are shy, some are bold, some are confident, some are easily frightened, some are more aggressive, and they show those differences consistently. So that is personality, except it's not a person, it's a non-person, but it's the same thing.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Carl Safina is our guest. His book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And we start with Chris in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
Sustaining member.
Thank you, Chris.
Uh-huh. I'm a disability. I usually give my cost of living increase back to you guys every year, but we're not getting one this year because the government is evil. But that's okay. I have two very, very wonderful stories, and God knows we could all use a smile on our faces about stuff. There is an elephant sanctuary, and it's either in Kentucky or Tennessee, and it's called the Elephant Sanctuary, and you can't go there. It's mostly animals that have been abused in circuses and zoos, but they have elephant cams, and you can go on the Internet and watch the elephants. That's all I'm going to say. It's a real interesting story, backstory. And then my sister gave me this fabulous journal for my birthday this year, and it's all handmade and wonderful, and it's made from elephant poop. And if I may, because this is way more concise than anything, just read the little insert that was with it, because it would take me that long to try and explain this anyways, just a couple paragraphs, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Okay. Sri Lanka is home to about a tenth of the estimated global total of 40,000 Asian elephants in the wild. Elephants are not being killed in Sri Lanka for their tusks, as tuskers are rare. They are not being killed for meat, since no one eats elephant meat. They are not being killed for their hides, since there's no market for elephant hides in the leather industry. Instead, elephants are being killed simply because they interfere with agriculture. Since 1950, it is likely that more than 4,000 elephants have been destroyed as a direct consequence of the conflict between men and elephants. The elephant is running out of space in Sri Lanka. Most of the protected areas inhabited by elephants are small, less than 900 square miles. Nevertheless, elephants, especially the bulls, may range over hundreds of square kilometers in the course of the season. Their sheer size and gargantuan appetite mean that elephants and people cannot live together where agriculture is the dominant form of land use.
All right, I need to hold you there, Chris, because we have a lot of calls coming in and limited time. Carl, would you like to respond?
Yeah, well, the one thing that leaps out right there is that after living on the planet for millions of years and being spread all across Asia and all across Africa, elephants are running out of room and people have to make paper out of their poop as a way of justifying their existence, and that's sad.
Yeah, that is sad. Let's go next to Rad, is it, in Minocqua. Hi, Rad.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for the show and for your great work. I've done a lot of wildlife work and conservation science work and management work with wildlife. And, you know, scientists are always telling you that you can't anthropomorphize how animals feel. You know, we have to just think of it as strictly biological, and it's all about numbers. And, you know, listening to your work, it just kind of reinforces my feeling that, yeah, you probably can anthropomorphize because these animals have feelings and needs and everything else too, and they're not just numbers to be managed on the landscape. And I'm wondering how you feel about the average biologist in academia saying, you know, that we probably can't anthropomorphize animals when we talk about their management.
I'm glad you called. You read about that, Carl.
Yeah, well, people who know one thing about animals seem to know this very awkward technical term, anthropomorphism. And they say you can't do that, which is to attribute human thoughts and emotions to other animals. And it makes no sense not to, because an animal that is curious looks curious and acts curious, and that's because it's curious. And one that is seeming to be frightened by something and is running away is frightened. And if you have a dog that seems happy, that's because it's a happy dog. So anthropomorphizing is usually, I think, the best and most logical first guess that you can make about what an animal is thinking or feeling. And then if you're fortunate, you can spend a lot of time watching and observing, and you can learn a lot more and have better insights and see if maybe you were wrong about something initially. But it certainly seems to me that as a starting point, the idea that they are thinking and feeling something that seems logical for the situation and about their behavior, in other words, are they happy, are they curious, are they afraid, are they feeling aggressive, are they getting defensive, are they hungry, that makes more sense as a first guess than seeing an animal that is behaving in some obvious way and saying, I have no idea what they could be doing or thinking. That doesn't make any sense.
So is anthropomorphizing allowed in academia now?
I mean, it's hard to answer a question about academia with a yes or no, because people in academia are people and they have a large range of opinions, and there's a lot of arguing about different things. But I would say, as a general rule, the people who study animals as subjects and run tests on their behavior and put them in little contraptions to see if they do this or that, they would probably say, no, you can't attribute human thoughts and emotions to them. And the people who study animals as they actually live their daily lives in the free living state, you know, just wild animals in nature, they don't ever talk about this because it's not interesting to them. It's not even a topic that's on their mind. It's just very obvious that animals do things because they have motivations that make sense in context.
More phone calls for Carl in a moment. Carl Safina is our guest this hour, author of the fascinating Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And we'll take more of your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian, and we are in our year-end membership drive here on listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the last hour you can pledge to our efforts, Monday through Thursday, 1 to 3. And your support is vital to us and to all that you hear on WPR. And it's why we're here to ask for your gift right now, as this year comes to an end. Make the programs you rely on possible when you give. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Yeah, this is the last, 23 minutes that you can show your support for the Kathleen Dunn Show. So make that call right now. We have a goal of 15 pledges, and we're looking for 9 more by the end of the hour. Make your donation right now. Support the programs you enjoy. Do it all at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Think about the quality of guests that you get on WPR. It's really extraordinary. And they also, when we hear from them almost every day, they know that you will ask great questions and that we won't have to have commercial interruptions. Your support makes this possible. You are the most reliable part of our budget. So please give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You probably listen to Wisconsin Public Radio all year. And you know what? You can donate the same way that you listen. And you can do that by becoming a sustaining member. You make the decision once, like right now, and you'll make affordable contributions, say maybe $10 a month, $20 a month, for as long as you wish.
It's very easy on your budget and also cuts down on paperwork. So become a sustainer now. WPR.org. 888-202-2552.
You might be thinking, well, I know tax dollars, right? Like federal dollars, state dollars already support Wisconsin Public Radio. Isn't that right? Well, it is right. They do, and we thank you for that.
But it's actually contributions from individual listeners that make the quality and the variety of programs possible. Listener support is actually the single biggest piece of our budget pie. It's you who makes the difference. Because this station matters to you, please make a personal contribution to pay for the radio programs that you listen to. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
The beauty of contributing to Wisconsin Public Radio is that it's always accessible and it's always a great value. And you can't really say that for everything you spend your hard-earned money on. You get to choose how much you pay for your listening, and you know that you'll tune in day after day, week after week, and get such a great return on all the money you invest. Give right now. You already know it's worth it. Just do it right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And thank you very much. Thanks, Lisa. Carl Safina is our guest. His latest book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. He looked at elephants, fascinating chapters on elephants in Kenya, wolves in Yellowstone, and humpback whales, killer whales in the Northwest Pacific. He has written a number of other books. His work has been recognized with MacArthur Pew Guggenheim Fellowships. He has a PhD in ecology from Rutgers, and he is the endowed chair for nature and humanity professor at Stony Brook University. He's also the host of the 10-part PBS series Saving the Ocean, and he's written for lots of top-notch publications, the New York Times, National Geographic, etc. We're welcoming phone calls for him, and we have many of them coming in, so let's go to you. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Joe in La Crosse. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was wondering, when animals are gazing at you and you look back at them, what they're thinking, particularly animals in zoos. We have a situation in La Crosse where they used to have a small time, and actually it was a despicable zoo about 10 years ago, and they closed it down. But now there's a couple of ladies that want to bring it back so that people can go to this despicable zoo that was there 10 years ago and have that same experience. Why they want to bring it back so people can, or how they thought that going to such a zoo was good and was just a despicable zoo, I don't know. So I was wondering if you could comment upon what animals think when they're looking at you from behind bars in a zoo?
Well, there are zoos and there are zoos. There are some zoos that do, I think, a really marvelous job of taking care of animals and introducing the public to the up-close sights and smells of other forms of life that we would otherwise have a hard time ever experiencing. And then there are other zoos that are pretty bad. Over the course of my lifetime, the quality of zoos in general has, in the United States anyway, has gone up tremendously. I think that there's almost no comparison between the zoo standards now compared to when I was a kid. Those creatures in zoos, you know, they don't have a personal relationship with most of the people who are viewing them. They do with their keepers, and the people who feed and take care of them often, depending, you know, on the animals, if they're creatures that have strong social bonds, like apes or elephants, they have strong bonds with their keepers, but the members of the general public are kind of irrelevant to them. So they're probably not thinking that much. They're probably thinking about, you know, their next meal or when they're going to get to see the keepers again.
And the elephants were able, the ones that you were watching in Kenya, are able to recognize a number of human beings, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very good at recognizing different people, and they can even recognize different kinds of people by recognizing human languages. And this has been shown experimentally by recording the conversations of tourists and the conversations of herding people who herd cows and goats, and playing those conversations through hidden speakers. And the elephants ignore the tourists because the tourists never do anything to the elephants. And the herders often hurt elephants. So when they hear the conversations of herders coming out of a hidden speaker, they bunch up and then they run away. They not only know that humans are different from other animals, they know that some humans are fine and others are dangerous.
Mm-hmm. What was this I thought was a remarkable story too, Carl. The elephant, what was it? It was a baby who was in trouble, who fell into something, and one of the people who works with them drove up in a car in the elephant and was trying to keep the mama from going to her baby. It was really amazing what the elephant did.
Well, they needed to get to the people needed to get to the baby who had fallen into a well. Now, over there, a well is what you might think of more as a maybe a cistern or something that is pretty wide. I mean, it's wide enough for an elephant to fall into. And this baby was stuck in this well, and they had to rope the baby up and then drag it out using the truck. That's obviously stressful for everybody, but the mother was frantic about the baby being in there. And when the people came, she initially was trying to prevent the people from getting to the baby, but not in an aggressive way at all. She was just trying to block them,
yeah.
not attack them, not hurt them, not charge the vehicle, not crush the vehicle. At one point, she sort of turned around and tried to sit on the hood of the truck. In other words, not ram it with her tusks or anything like
mm-hmm.
that. She wasn't trying to hurt them, but she was afraid for her baby. And then they managed to, by yelling at her a lot, they knew her and she knew them, and by yelling at her a lot, they managed to get her to back away, and then they got the baby out and there was an instant reunion and everybody was happy.
Let's go. Thanks so much, Joe, for your call. Let's go to Jim in Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good afternoon. I have a question, a fascinating subject, about evidence of creativity in animals. And there's a certain bird I know that collects blue objects and makes a display for its potential mate. What is any evidence of creativity in animals?
Yeah, there's a little bit, and it's different. There are different animals that use different tools, and they don't all use the same kinds of tools across the entire range of the species. some in certain areas use a certain kind of thing. I'm thinking mainly of chimpanzees now. In certain places they use sticks, in certain places they use stones. They learn that from each other. That's a kind of a cultural thing. There is a well-documented story of a baby dolphin that was watching a keeper on a cigarette break. The keeper was looking through the window while he was smoking a cigarette, and this baby dolphin, it was in an aquarium. The baby dolphin in the aquarium was looking through the window at the keeper, who was looking back, and the keeper was smoking, and the baby went over to her mother and nursed for a few moments and then came back to the window and released a cloud of milk that enveloped
her head goodness.
Like a cloud of smoke.
Really?
And, you know, that's a pretty incredible feat, because somehow this little nursing-age baby dolphin had to have the idea of going and using milk to represent something that she was seeing through the glass. So when people use one thing to represent another, we call that art. Now, that kind of creativity, I think, is exceptionally unusual in other members of the animal kingdom. But there is some, and I think what there is more of, I think, is a lot of aesthetic sensibility. All of these beautiful plumes that different species have, and the incredibly beautiful colors of fish and things like that, they're at some level they are appreciated by the others, because otherwise they wouldn't all look that way. I mean, they are functioning because there is a recognition of the meaning and value of those colors and those extraordinary plumes and all these things that look to us really beautiful and in some cases really outlandish. And they are there for a reason. There are other stories of chimpanzees climbing tall trees to just gaze at beautiful sunsets. So I think that an aesthetic sense is probably more common than creating something that's not there, what we would call creativity. That's not too common. That's something that is one of the things that I think helps to set humans apart a little differently from many of the others.
Thank you so much, Jim. And a final call from Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just had a quick story about a little deer mouse that I raised, brought over from by a neighbor, very tiny. And so I kept her in an aquarium. And most days, if it was nice, we would go outside to let her forage, and I kind of researched some different foods out there, so I'd have them ready, and we'd go outside, and she would eat that, and then we'd come inside, and I'd put her back in the aquarium. So we did that for some time, and then one day I looked, and she was not in the aquarium, and so my heart sank, but I called her name, which was Millie, short for Milagro in Spanish, and she came to me. And then I put her back in the aquarium, and that happened a second time. The second time I thought, what are the chances that she'll ever respond? She did. And so that was my wake-up call to say it's time for her to be released. So I brought her out into our garden that has a fence so that the deer can't come in. And I sat down with her, and she ran around like she did when she would forage, and she was gone. And then I thought, you know, I was thinking about her and thought, well, she's gone now. And she came back and jumped onto my knee, and then she disappeared.
Carl?
Yeah, those are the kinds of experiences that are possible when we actually have a relationship with another animal. Now, how many people in the course of our whole lives ever have any kind of relationship whatsoever with a member of another species? Other than a couple of our domestic animals, many people have dogs and cats, but, you know, who has an experience like raising a mouse,
right,
or raising any kind of wild animal? But when you do, you find astonishing things about how relational they are, especially when they're young and they're very, very playful. how responsive they are, how much they recognize you, or will come when you call, or those kinds of things. And we've had a couple of young orphans that we've bottle raised and then done what I call a soft release, which is to have a nest box for them or some sort of housing that they are raised in when they're very young, but with an open door to the outside, so that as they get old enough to start exploring, they can begin to come and go. And our most recent experience was a squirrel that we found as a little tiny infant crawling around in a parking lot with no apparent nest anywhere in sight. We bottle raised this little baby squirrel, and we did this soft release kind of thing like I'm referring to, and she eventually went and found some place to live way in the woods behind our house, but would come almost every day and jump all over us and get tickled and eat out of our hands and all kinds of fun stuff, you know. And normally you just see squirrels at the bird feeder and you say, oh, those stupid
right,
squirrels,
get out of here.
They are. Uh-huh. Or some people see squirrels and just want to call the exterminator because they're afraid that they're going to make a hole in the house and come in the attic or something like that. But when you when your relationship is not one of fear and you do actually have the ability to experience what they are like and their personalities and how well they interact, it's embarrassing to say how it's so surprising, because we shouldn't be surprised.
Right.
That is the way that they are, you know.
Yeah.
They've always been that way.
Yeah. Thank you, Carl, so much. We have to do our year-end membership, but thank you so much. Thanks for the book. It's great. Beyond Words is Carl Safina's latest book, What Animals Think and Feel. And it's really, really fascinating. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Lisa Nalbandian, and you can make WPR programs possible like the one you just heard. It was fascinating. Squirrels and elephants and dolphins and wolves and, oh my, I love that stuff. It's not stuff. That's a bad word. All that fascinating information. Sorry. So if you enjoyed it as well, go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
All right, Kathleen, here's the status. We need five more pledges.
Only five.
We
all
can
right,
do this.
Let's
go. But we have 3 minutes to do it.
All right.
So we
got
to do it fast. Give to WPR right now. Support the programs you rely on. Thank you so much to the 10 of you that have pledged this hour. If you haven't given yet, the time is right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
This holiday season, you can let the impact of your pledge go beyond great radio to people who are in need in your area. Ask for food for $20 when you give $60, food for $40 when you give $120, and your gift will provide meals to a Wisconsin food bank near you. So it's two great things at once. You're helping us. You're helping people who need food. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You might pay $100 a month for your cable service. You're willing to do that because you get entertainment and information all month long.
Yes. Well, you get those same things on this station, Lisa.
That's
and
right.
In fact, the quality of what you get from WPR is really unmatched. Become a sustaining member with a 9XM leadership gift of $100 a month or more. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. We still need five more pledges.
Hey, think about this, right? WPR is your daily companion. We're on the air 24 hours a day, whether you're at home, whether you're driving in the car, at the office, whether you're concentrating really hard on the topic or just relaxing.
And you count on us, you really do, for news and intelligent mm-hmm. conversation. And so we count on you to support what you hear. It's how public radio works. Give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Here's the test. If you've never given before, but you look forward to listening to Wisconsin Public Radio every single day, that's a sign that it's time to donate. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this show. Thanks to Katie Madsen-Cyrus for all her help, too. And thank you for listening.